welcome to Inspired Island, where every episode we sit down with someone living an inspired life here on Vashon Island in Puget Sound. From world-class artists and musicians to chefs and business owners, our little rural island has it all. I'm your host, Grace McCray, a new full-time Vashon Island resident, and thank you for joining me on this journey to discover why Vashon is such an inspired island. And welcome back to Inspired Island, everyone. I'm really glad to have you joining us for this conversation today. We are in for a treat because we have Odin Lonning in the studio today. Welcome to Inspired Island, Odin.
Gunashchish. Thank you.
Odin is an award-winning professional native artist from Juneau, Alaska. He is a very prolific artist. He's carved totem poles and house posts for clients in Chicago, Portland, Paris. So really, he's an international artist. In 2005, I learned that he completed a 10-foot killer whale and thunderbird totem for Everett Community College, which is a big college north of Seattle, which I think is really cool for students to be able to witness and connect with his art. Odin is also an educator, which I'm excited to learn more about. Odin's wife, Orca Annie, is also somebody that we hope to interview soon. So she will undoubtedly come up many times in this interview, and I will be excited to get into more of the details and her perspective in a future date. So Odin and I have spent a few minutes talking over the phone in preparations for this interview, and I've waved to you, Odin, and your wife on the beach while we wait for killer whales to pass Vashon Island, but this is the first time we've been able to sit down and really have a conversation, so I'm excited to have the listeners be able to join us on this journey. So I do know that you were born in Juneau, Alaska. Did you spend most of your childhood there?
All the way through high school, and at that point, wanderlust took over, and I found myself heading south for different reasons and bouncing back and forth, and finally winding up in Seattle permanently and eventually Vashon.
Could you share a little bit about your lineage and your family roots, as I think that will be very important for the conversation?
Well, of course, my name is a clue as to something else, Scandinavian. My dad was from Oslo, Norway, and I got his name, Odin. Mm. I also have a Tlingit name, which was given at a potlatch, which is Schnautan, but my mother was Tlingit, and my dad was Norwegian. So,
And how did they meet?
I think in a very common fashion. And maybe this relates to where I got my wanderlust. My dad evidently left Norway as a teenager in search of adventure and wound up in Alaska, worked on the Alcan Highway, became a fisherman, and ran into my mother at a cannery, I believe, which is, again, a historically common occurrence back in those days, the early days. In Southeast Alaska, you had a lot of everything going on, lumber, fishing industry, canneries all over up and down Southeast Alaska. And of course, fishermen would be at canneries and processing plants. And so that's where they met. And here I am all these years later.
And what was your childhood like, if you had to describe it?
Well, something to be really proud of, because now it's entered into my teaching style, which is to talk about respect for nature. And I keep hearing from people that that's something that needs to be talked about more. So I grew up not on sports fields playing baseball. I was hiking around alpine meadows, going up river valleys, on beaches in wild places, and feeling perfectly at home. A little bit of subsistence fishing in my family. My dad was a janitor for many years, so certainly not wealthy by any stretch. And in the summertime, weekend camping trips were a common thing. He had a small, I think about a 25-foot wooden boat that we would go out and camp and cook fish right out of the water in onto the campfire, Dungeness crab literally out of the pot and on into the fire, you know, that kind of thing. So, yeah, very much nature connected.
And how did art show up in your childhood? Was it something that was always around? What's your earliest memories interacting with art?
Well, again, to be going back to proper values, native values, traditional native values, it's proper to acknowledge where you get a gift or direction or something like that. But my mother, being of the boarding school generation, was not a fluent language speaker, not really knowledgeable about Tlingit culture. But what she did was, when I was 10 years old, took me to the performance of a very traditional dance group from Haines, Clakwan area, at the high school in Juneau. And there's all kinds of ways I could put it. It blew my mind. It opened my eyes. It raised what I call pride hairs on the back of my neck when I experienced this dance group of mostly elders, but there were children in the group. They were wearing regalia that had been passed down from generation to generation, I found out later. Very impressive regalia. So from that point on, I had to know, what is this all about? What is this culture, this art? And I was looking in books, practicing copying designs, teaching myself to draw, paint, carve. And here I am, still a student of different things, but still a student, even though I have been teaching.
You spoke about the importance of nature being everywhere around you growing up. Could you talk a little bit about the importance of killer whales and salmon specifically in Tlingit art?
Well, not just Tlingit, but Haida, Tsimshian, in British Columbia, all the tribes up and down the coast from Alaska to Washington. And not just killer whales and salmon, but specifically to Tlingit culture and Haida, animals are a way of, well, traditionally, a way of talking about who your ancestors were based on crest and clan and areas that you, your people come from. There's a term in Tlingit, Hashuka, which means our ancestors. And if you attend a performance of a dance group, of which there are many around Puget Sound, I belong to one, Kutia Dancers, and you'll see button robes with usually made out of wool, applique wool, two colors of wool, with a design of a bear, a frog, a salmon, a killer whale, a shark, often decorated with abalone buttons, hence the term button robe. But when you see a dancer performing and, let's say, coming into a room, the whole group coming in, many times the dancers will be wearing the robes and have their backs turned to the audience. So you see what the design is on the back of that robe. And as a elder of a dance group once put it, I thought pretty eloquently, the crest are speaking for them. Excuse me for slipping into an accent. getting ready to move into theatrical field too, so I'm practicing my accents. But the artwork is all about identifying family history, stories, and identifying the person wearing whatever animal it might be. You'll see a shark on my regalia because of my mother's clan that she belonged to. It's a matrilineal society, so you are what your mother was. And so in my case, I have the right to wear eagle and shark and murrelet. Those are designs that identify where my mother's people came from.
What's the last, the third one that you mentioned?
Oh, murrelet, marbled murrelet.
It's
technically a seabird that lives in the forest, in the woods. When you see a, and they're not that common, a small bird, brown with a light-colored chest. Marbled murrelet is the full, well, there's a couple of species, but You might see them flying from the salt water, and you'll see them going up into the woods where their nest is, which is kind of interesting and unusual for a seabird to live in a tree.
But when you're still living in Alaska, did you have any inkling that becoming an artist yourself was potentially a future career path for you?
I think it forced its way into my conscious permanently over stages. I mean, of course, when you're in high school, your mind is taken over by hormones and lots of other things. But even in high school, I became a musician, a drummer. I still am. And I'm trying to figure out how to bring music back into my career. But artwork was always there, kind of either as a hobby in those days or a sideline income. And of course, once I realized I was getting good enough to sell my work, well, okay, that's incentive. So it's always, even after I started leaving Juno and pretty much left permanently, then art became a real part of my life. Working with stores, galleries, doing art shows, things like that.
Was the move to Seattle at all because of the desire to have your art reach a broader audience?
I think actually it was just, at first, a love of Seattle. Because, you know, I mentioned wanderlust, or whatever you want to call it, adventurous spirit. I have three older sisters, and I'm the only one, strangely, that seemed to have any interest in music and art, also in traveling. Many relatives in Juneau could never understand why I was constantly leaving and then permanently left Juneau, which I'm sure is fairly common. You know, it's when I look back on it, it's almost like I seem to have something against staying in Juneau. So I just loved the way Seattle was, of course, being a waterfront, you know, type of the environment, and the energy just seemed comfortable to me.
Could you talk about a couple of your favorite commissions that you've done? Because I know you've done a lot of commission work, both for, you know, individuals, I'm sure, but also universities and I'm sure many other organizations. Could you just give us a little taste of a couple of your favorites?
Yeah, and you could also put it in terms of the most interesting, unusual, perhaps. And that would have been two 12-foot-tall totems for the Archdiocese of Seattle on 2nd and Stewart in downtown Seattle. There's a building which, going back in time, was the largest hotel. It was a hotel for many years with a lobby that contained a large fireplace and two, I have to say, cheesy totems made out of cement, probably crafted by a company back east or something, which back in those days, you know, I'm guessing early 20s, even before that, I think. I would have to look it up again. But anyway, it was a hotel for many years. It changed. That fireplace was walled over. The totems were removed, and it was forgotten about. Anyway, the Archdiocese purchased that building. It is now, I think, 10 floors of apartment buildings, low-income apartment buildings. There is a chapel on the bottom floor. And when somebody discovered that hidden fireplace, they decided, why don't we bring it back to the way it was and even make it better? So they hired a tile artist. They hired a carpenter to do the work around the mantle in the fireplace, and they found me and asked me to do a couple of totems that would be real and that would speak to the history of Catholic Church and the early interactions with Native people of Puget Sound. So the two poles wound up being the history of Native people and the Catholic Church. That was very interesting.
I imagine. Yeah. That'd be juicy, I'm sure.
For a number of reasons.
You did mention, you know, these the cement totems that were a bit cheesy and you're not sure the background of it. I'd be curious to know your personal perspective, or your family's perspective on, say, myself as somebody who's non-Indigenous. What either advice or parameters would you think is acceptable and respectful when it comes to interacting with Native art? Like, I know there's a lot of talk these days about cultural appropriation of Native art, et cetera. And I think in this region that happens quite a bit. These days, as people's awareness and, like, I think just consciousness is rising. I'd love to know your personal perspective, if you have anything for our listeners to consider, I guess, when they're looking at Native art.
Well, it's a multifaceted topic, I think. Just in terms of art, I can address that hopefully quickly and easily, because when I would demonstrate in public, work on an art piece like on the porch of the Roastery, which in the summertime is a great place to be in the sunshine and do work. And of course, people see you and some stop and ask, what are you doing? And the usual questions. So eventually I would get, I think if I look back, I'd probably think of at least five examples of a woman asking me, I want to do a button robe. Is it okay if I do a button robe? And that was as far as they could go as far as a question. And I would say, well, what do you mean? And, you know, I always have my photo book with me so I can show examples of, and oftentimes people would have a hard time even phrasing the question. So, but the gist of it is, at first I was, you know, years ago, a little defensive, like a lot of Native artists are, but I finally realized, okay, the way to approach this specific question is, I would explain what the button robe is, what its purpose always has been, and then cite an example and say that if you want to do a button robe, first of all, make sure you do your own design. Don't copy something that you saw in a book, because even though it's in a book, there are still people alive today that are related to the people, the families that had that button robe back in the 1800s. So if you were to copy that exact design, that is considered cultural infringement or whatever legal term you want to use. But so basically I would say a button robe is simply an art form. And so if it looks Native, that's okay, as long as you're not stepping on the toes of somebody currently living by copying their personal family design. So that's just the easiest one to deal with.
Yeah. And I think what that example shows me also is just the importance of art as an education opportunity too. And I think maybe that's how your educator and your artist sensibilities kind of combine.
Yeah, exactly. The other facets of that question, another one is, maybe this is the more familiar one, cultural appropriation. Let's say a bunch of non-Native people sitting around a drum imitating a powwow drum, making up their own songs. And to Native people of any tribe, that's, I'm sure I could come up with another cultural example, but it's basically insulting. It implies that you're just, what you think of that culture is nothing more than fun and games. Another example might be somebody wearing a beadwork and leather and for Halloween. You know, it's not as bad as going back in history where somebody would wear blackface and really be insulting. But it's very close to it. So cultural appropriation could be using or misusing someone else's culture and art forms and traditions. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for sharing that with us. It's very, deep. And I think as a, broader society, there's still so much work even in 2023 to be doing there. So thank you so much for sharing your back to your time here in Seattle. Is that where you met your wife, Orko Annie?
No, actually right here on Vashon.
Oh, okay. Well, would you mind sharing the story from your perspective?
Yeah, and of course it makes sense to bring up how she wound up. And of course she'll be covering that herself, but she got her name from the Whale Museum up in Friday Harbor as an intern. Spent time up there and realized that it was a difficult place to live, monetarily speaking. Anyway, she moved to Vashon because she heard that whales, killer whales, were often seen around Vashon in the winter months. And of course, back in the early 90s, when she was up Friday Harbor, you could simply, from the beginning, spring until fall, go out to the west side of San Juan Island and almost be guaranteed to see J, K, and L pods going up and down what people call the West Side Shuffle in the good old days because of the fish going up to the Fraser River. For them, it was a guaranteed food source. So anyway, she moves to Vashon, I think, 92. And for me, I was living in Seattle, dancing with the Kutia dancers. And I got an invitation to come and help Israel Shotridge, who was a totem carver. He had, I think, three commissions of, I forgot which, 8-foot poles, like a house post or something. And he needed help in getting those, He probably had a timeline to complete them, so I came over to help him. There was an art show that was curated at the old Blue Heron building. I participated in it with a drum that had a killer whale design on it. And as it turns out, Orko Annie was looking for native collaboration, or at least interested in finding native people that were of the same mindset. The way she puts it, she was not seeing any native participation in killer whale conservation at all.
Oh.
And she was hoping to find someone. She went to that art show, saw the drum, and as she puts it, I think she had to know, who is this artist that did a nice killer whale design on a drum? We met, and here we are 23 years later.
Beautiful.
And today, that's exactly why, and it's her creation. It's something that she's created, and we still do, Kichuka, killer whales from indigenous perspective. We've done numerous presentations here on Vashon at the theater, Land Trust building, Ober Park building, and then for various reasons, things kind of evaporated, slowed down, and of course the COVID thing put an end to it. But it's time to go back and ramp it up.
yes, please. I would love to attend.
And one of the things that's exciting for me is that what we're doing has never been done by anybody before. And I keep running into that all the time with my teaching ideas, and that's exciting and energizing. Things that have not been done before.
Yes. Well, as we're sitting here recently, J-Pod came to Vashon Island. I just can't believe the orca's ability to bring people, all different generations, to the beach and just the pure joy. And I just feel like there's something there in terms of the orca's ability to bring people together and hopefully transition that joy of just the experience of witnessing them into more conservation and learning about the connections with native peoples in this region, et cetera. I feel like they're like this window into all these different things to learn and uncover about the world that we live in.
Something there. Yeah. And that's definitely a lot of ways to address that. And some of them are contentious because of what's going on with the whales, the fact that they're critically endangered. Going back to 1999 when I started collaborating and realized that Orca Annie and myself are on the same page.
Mm.
You know, we joined ACS, American Cetacean Society, Seattle chapter. I'm not sure if you're even aware. They're not very good at tooting their own horn, I don't think.
Mm.
Are you aware of ACS?
Very, just surface level. Like, I've heard the name before, yeah.
So that was the beginning of my education from a non-native perspective, joining ACS, becoming a board member, and unfortunately realizing the politics involved with conservation issues. What I mean by that, basically, one of the most contentious might be way back then, my wife had the first real hydrophone on Vashon in Colvos Pass, and it was set up by a professional. We monitored it all the time in the old school way. It was on all the time, and if whales were in the area, it would come across the computer. We could hear it and see it on a screen. But Anne's attitude, and still is, she's all about the whales, not people. And so very soon, with her having a hydrophone, people were pressuring her to, oh, you've got to share those calls instantly with everybody.
Mm.
And her attitude was, no, I don't want boats crowding the whales.
Mm.
So contentious with a capital C, we wound up having to leave ACS because they were not standing up for the right things, which was the whales.
Yeah, that's a big one, and I'll be excited to talk to Orca Annie about it as well. Yeah, what is the right, where's the line that's crossed where you start impeding with the whales' ability to feed themselves and to travel the way they want to travel, and
survive.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
it's harder and harder.
A lot of people, I think, don't really focus on how much on the edge they are. I mean, there's a photograph on the front page of the Beachcomber, the Tacoma Tribune, on and on and on. Any paper in the local area that became aware of their visit to Quartermaster Harbor, there's a photograph of a breaching whale. And how many people realize, oh my God, that whale is skinny?
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody. And that's the problem.
Yeah.
Everybody's focused on, oh, I got my Kodak moment.
Yeah.
Do they really care that they're right on the edge of disappearing forever?
Yeah.
What are you going to do when that happens? Go harass humpbacks?
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, I know. And it's so urgent and dire.
Yeah. I mean, when you compare how people react and feel and think about the whales and the fact that it's almost like the iconic symbol of Puget Sound, and yet at the same time, is there any sacrifice? Is anybody making any attempt to sacrifice for them?
Mm.
They are doing, sorry, Anne, I'm stealing one of your lines. They have been doing all the sacrificing. And what are we doing?
Yeah.
Nothing. I like to, and this is good practice for me, to put things in a cultural, native perspective. Because when we do Kichika, that's my job. She's the killer whale expert, and I can insert little bits and pieces about ancestors' attitudes and native values. So when we do a presentation, maybe I'll talk about, try to picture what it was like pre-contact in this Salish Sea or in Southeast Alaska, where you traveled by canoe from your village to another village, like people commute nowadays in a car. But imagine in a canoe, and there are killer whales around you all the time, and you communicate with them. And some people might smirk at that, oh, communicate, yeah, right. And this is a challenge when I'm going to really start teaching Native people, is how to talk about my own personal beliefs that if you go back in time far enough, humans had the ability to communicate with animals telepathically. Mm. And people, yeah, right, you know, have a furled eyebrow and, you know, maybe an outright laugh. Yeah, right, telepathic, sure. And I try to even define it as in not words, but, and this is my own theory, because everyone's entitled to their own theory, right? Mm-hmm. I think, especially with killer whales, telepathy is a way they communicate besides their usual echolocation. I think they communicate by image and emotion from one mind to another whale, one whale to another. And I have a reason for saying that, but going back to my own belief about humans being able to do that, there are many tribal stories that talk about humans being able to communicate with animals. And as we evolved, quote unquote, I think we're devolving right now, we lost that ability. And that's my attitude, and I'm sticking to it.
No, I think that's full. That strikes a chord with me on a personal level, too. And I mean, even if I just think about, this is a silly example, but my dog who lives in the house, you know, we do not have any shared language. I guess he knows a few words. He's been taught that cheese means a tasty treat, things like that. But just like there's this energy, and I feel like we feed off of each other's energy. I'm just so in tune. I feel like that used to be expanded probably outside of the home with all the creatures that you would live with. So that it's not a huge stretch of my imagination to believe that.
Yeah, we scientists claim to know much more about the human brain and how it works than pick your number of years ago, but what is the common statement? 20% of our brain is used, or it may be less than that, I'm not even sure, but I think about killer whales, they have the biggest brain in the salt water, Anne might correct me on that, but that's another thing that makes you think if you really ponder it, you know, the possibilities. And one of the reasons I bring that up, besides my own personal experience with other animals, which won't go into here because there's not enough time, but I've watched, of course, thanks to, from 1999, going out with Anne and working with Mark Sears, a researcher. In the old days, we would drive and keep track of the whales coming down East Passage or maybe Covos so that Mark could catch up with them. He would have to know where they were so he could jump in his boat and catch up with them if he was, you know, behind, you know, their arrival and didn't know where they were exactly. Nowadays, everybody knows instantly where they are. But anyway, in watching the pods, and you notice behavior, you start to formulate, well, in my case, theories, which of course I can't prove, but echolocation is one thing. It's pretty amazing. They can be in the ferry lane at the north end and probably click all the way down towards Tacoma and tell, are there any fish in the water? And if not, all right, let's turn around and leave. Why bother going down there? But there have been times when I've witnessed pods doing things with no sound, and this is back to the days of Anne's hydrophone in Colvos Pass, at the Cove Apartments first, and then down Cove Walk, another house. But more than one location, I saw two pods. One pod was leading or ahead of another. It might have been J and K pods, but one pod decided to change location, started to turn around, and the other pod, which was not within visual range and no sound being made, turned around and started leaving first. So it's like, to me, that looks like there was communication without audio. Mm. It was something else going on. And I've seen others examples of that. So that kind of validated and still does my theory about how they communicate.
Yeah. There's just so much, you know.
We don't know.
Don't know, for a lack of a better word, like this beautiful, like, it's not magic per se, but, you know, that sort of unknowable aspect to it, that it just makes it all that much more heartbreaking that this species and many other species are just being allowed to get to the state they're in.
At the risk of sounding harsh, you know, Orca Annie hasn't come up with this. It just occurred to me just now. Well, maybe she did. We might be loving or helping to love them to death.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, I have never seen Point Robinson the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
You could not find a parking spot anywhere on the road, a quarter mile at the top. Point Jensen. Mm-hmm. I'd never seen that parking lot filled, where there literally was no more places to park and people were out on the street. That was alarming, even at a gut level, not even thinking about, okay, what does that mean? Anne is good at expressing, what does that mean? And she can really dive into that in detail. But
yeah, I'd love to have a conversation. Yeah, and I mean, myself, it's important in perspective, because that's not necessarily my first gut reaction. My first gut is kind of like, oh, look, you know, so many people to hopefully start getting involved and become activists in their own way and try to force governmental change, et cetera. But yeah, from the orca's perspective, you know, how much load, you know, can they bear? So yeah, I'd love to have more conversations too with Anne about that.
And you will.
I'm excited. I think we all are. And Odin, thinking about sort of what's on your plate right now, what's on the horizon for you, anything exciting? I know you told me that you have some teaching and co-training plans going on.
Well, yeah, I call it a teaching program. I mean, and again, going back to what I said at the beginning about acknowledging people that put me on the path, my mother was the first one, obviously, but I joined a dance group back in, I wouldn't say joined the group, but I performed with a group in Juneau. And then I joined the Kutia Dancers in the Seattle area, 1992. And I realized doing that was going to help me learn not just a little bit of the language, you know, through songs, but also the culture behind the art. And everything has been kind of wanting to weave itself. I mean, metaphor is common in the art, and something called potlatch oratory, where a speaker would address an audience of invited guests and be good at saying multiple things at the same time. It always has been considered an art form, one that I'm trying to learn. And just simply using a metaphor is not necessarily that skill. My teaching program, I call it a basket. I'm trying to weave a basket. And the basket is my imagination, other people's imagination, students, resources, warp and weft. And that basket will benefit a lot of people when it's created. I could also use the metaphor of I'm trying to create a canoe, and students will become my paddlers and propel the canoe who knows where. So teaching, especially, I realized that when I wanted to start teaching the art, naturally, my first thought was, oh, yeah, how to paint, how to draw, how to carve two-dimensional and three-dimensional. Then I realized, oh, wait a minute, no. I need to address, where does this art come from, the culture behind it? And then that led to, oh, yeah, who's talking about native values, you know, and how important that is. Because nowadays, integrity and respect for others and respect for nature, if ever was there was a time when those things needed to be talked about, it's now.
Yeah.
And I keep hearing from people, hey, Odin, boy, you know, it seems like people are really interested in or wanting to be interested in Native culture and nature, for that matter. Well, I mean, look at the popularity of Vashon's Nature School. It's been steadily growing, and that's just one example. There's all kinds of those around Puget Sound and everywhere. So when it comes to Native population of Seattle, of which 4,500, I think, is the roughly population of Alaska Natives, I've detected a real hunger for the culture, because a lot of them were either born in Seattle or left Alaska early and haven't had a chance to connect. So first the art, and weaving in, again, a metaphor, information and respect for nature. I think that's really important.
Yeah, that's beautiful that you're passing, you know, that along, and the ripple effects, I think, will go on for a long, long time.
I don't know if I read this or heard it from somebody. The best way to learn is to teach. It sounds good. I don't know if it's a real thing, but it is. Sure. It's working for me.
Yeah. And
by collaborating with people, that's going to increase my learning. Like, for instance, when I started making a list of what I'm going to teach, it started off with the basic, you know, the physical art. Then I realized, okay, protocol, cultural protocol, what to do at a potlatch, how to handle yourself, how to show respect for elders. Do you want to learn a song? Okay, I can teach you songs. Ethnobotany, plants that you can go out in the woods and survive if you have to. Mm-hmm. What is food? What is medicine? And the term medicine, by the way, I've been using that as a metaphor. And people ask, what do you mean by that? And I say, well, my personal medicine, something that makes me feel good in body and mind. Well, that's the definition of medicine, something that makes you feel good physically and in your mind. So for me, my personal medicines are nature, the artwork that I do, and now sharing the artwork. Those are really powerful. And of course, for Anne, killer whales are her medicine. And sharing about killer whales.
Yeah. Wow, that's so beautiful that you've found that and continue to learn about what serves your soul and your bodies. So yeah, thank you so much. And thank you so much for being so generous with your time today and your perspective with myself and our listeners. It's been an honor. We end every show with a fun lightning round of questions just to get to know you and your life here on Vashon a little bit better. The first question is, do you have a favorite beverage on Vashon? Any place you like to get a cup of coffee or tea?
French roast at the roastery.
Ooh, good one. Classic. If you're not at home or work, where can people most often find you on the island? Do you have any favorite haunts?
Boy, there is none. But again, and I'm starting to sound like a plug for the roastery, but in the summer months, that's my favorite place to be in public working. But I'm working on other places to pop up, so to speak.
Yeah, excellent. And do you have a favorite Vashon Island tradition that you like to share with the community?
Vashon-specific tradition? I would have to say not really. Again, because of where I grew up, nature is my, our Jack Russell Terrier is my, I call her my exercise program, wanting to go out and deer trail, as I call it. And so there are favorite places on Vashon on the south end, and odd as it sounds. And again, because of where I grew up, places where you won't see people. I would rather run into animals than people. I know that sounds bad, but
no. Well, there's some wondrous, you know, wildlife and creatures that share this island. So yeah, that's lovely. And lastly, but certainly not least, where can people find you to learn more about you and your work and what you're up to?
Well, one of the things that's hopefully going to come to pass, I've signed up and applied to the Swiftwater Gallery to become one of their members, of which I think now is 51 currently, but they're going to add. And part of my application included mention of classes that I'll teach, not necessarily Tlingit culture, but things like graphic art designing and that type of thing. So I have a feeling, and I hope, that I will be doing more things in public, and Anne and I both doing more things in public, presentations. There's endless collaborations that can happen. The the library, Heritage Museum, the list goes on. So yeah, it's all about connecting dots, and for me, connecting with people. So, and of course, wherever I feel comfortable demonstrating, I can often be seen at a park, on a beach, carving out of it. One of the first little mini articles that the Beachcomber ever did, they saw me carving in one of the downtown parks. I was working on a piece, and somebody thought it was interesting, and I still have that Beachcomber copy, but nothing has changed from then to now. I'm still out and about.
Excellent. Well, yeah, hopefully our listeners will get a chance to run into you soon. Thanks again so much for coming in today, Odin, and send our best to Orga Annie. And thank you all for listening. Again, this is Inspired Island on Voice of Vashon, KVSH LP Vashon. Until next time, stay inspired.